Hello and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations. In this new podcast, Lowy Institute researchers will delve into the big issues in international affairs through discussions with experts around the world. My name is Ben Bland, and I'm the director of the Southeast Asia program here at the Lowy Institute. Today, we're going to be talking about the coup in Myanmar and where the country goes from here. It's now more than 2 weeks since the military seized power and detained Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Since then, Senior General Min Aung Hlaing has rounded up hundreds of politicians, activists, journalists and protesters. Among those detained is Sean Turnell, an Australian academic and friend of the Institute who spent many years advising Aung San Suu Kyi on economic reform. We hope that Sean and the others who've been unfairly detained are all released soon. To help us make sense of recent events, I'm joined by Amin Thant, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist in Yangon, and Melissa Crouch, a law professor at the University of New South Wales and an expert on the Myanmar constitution. A, I want to start by asking you, what's the latest situation on the ground in Yangon?
It's always a little bit, or lately it's been difficult to say exactly what the latest situation is, especially in the mornings, since the military has been cutting off internet. This is our second night in a row where we didn't have internet from 1 a.m. to 9 a.m. So we've only had internet back for about half an hour at this point. But you know, in the last couple of days, what we've been seeing is an escalation of security force violence towards protesters, as well as protesters getting more strategic and specific in terms of what actions they're carrying out. So, for example, yesterday, we saw that security forces were trying to force central bank employees, all of whom are civil servants, who many of whom are participating in the civil disobedience movement and therefore are on strike, to go back to work. And, you know, this is made a little bit easier by the fact that they live in what are essentially dorms on the property of the bank. And, you know, you had protesters who in previous days might have been marching all around various cities or just like, you know, on main streets, really focusing on places like the central bank in order to try and prevent the reopening of the bank and the forcing of these employees back to work. We're also seeing just generally more violence. There's been some standoffs between pro-military and pro-democracy protesters. We're also seeing more shootings, although, you know, there's been some reports of live bullets, and obviously one woman was shot in the head with a live bullet. It's largely been contained to rubber bullets and water cannons at the present. But yeah, you know, what we're seeing now is more and more military on the ground, whereas before we had largely police, even though, you know, they did have quite large weapons, riot shields, those sorts of things. Now we're really starting to see, you know, fairly well-known battalions like the 77th Light Infantry, who are quite well-known for how brutally they've repressed protesters in the past.
And obviously, measures like the internet shutdowns are designed to cut off information, the military presence designed to increase a sense of fear and uncertainty. What impact has this had on people in Yangon and in Myanmar and protesters? Are people more afraid to go out on the streets? Is this starting to change the dynamics on the ground, do you think?
It definitely is causing a lot of fear. You know, I think Myanmar is always scarier at night, even in normal times. There's always been concerns about crime, but also sort of like the darkness laws of the past has meant that being outside at night, gathering at night, has been criminalized. So right now, what we're seeing, especially during the nighttime, are neighborhood patrols where people are very wary of strangers coming into their neighborhoods at night. This is complicated by the fact that 23,000 inmates were recently released during a national amnesty. This is, you know, a fairly common occurrence in Myanmar to do prisoner amnesties, but this is the largest amount we've ever seen. You know, it's very reminiscent of a similar amnesty that was used in 1988, which was used to essentially engineer sort of mass paranoia and violence that eventually led to the beheading of some of these people who were recently released from prison. During the day, you know, people are more scared. I think there's less of a sort of the mood of the first few days of protests, which really felt like a party in many places, unless you were directly near police officers. And there weren't quite as many police on the ground. outside of a few key areas like surrounding City Hall. But despite all of that, there's still this sort of like maliciously happy defiance. Yesterday, a tank broke down in Yangon, and people were offering to give them a tow to the nearest mechanic in order to help them. You saw quite a lot of tanks essentially being vandalized by pro-democracy stickers. And so, you know, like people seem like they're not that afraid even to confront a tank. But they are generally sort of picking their targets a little bit more as opposed to kind of just wandering around and having a more of a party atmosphere as they protest.
It seems then that the internet, that the arrival of cheap and well spread out communications around Myanmar has really changed the dynamics from previous periods of military control in the country, where people have more avenues and in a way people are more brave to push back openly.
Yeah, and I think it's not just the internet, right? Like over the first weekend after the coup, the internet was pretty much completely shut down. People found it very difficult to get online. And despite all of that, the morning after the internet was shut down for the first time, you saw massive amounts of people in the street. And they clearly had been communicating with one another. There's been so many new amendments to laws coming out and like proposed changes to existing proposals. I think that's the right way to phrase it. That like no one really knows what's illegal at this point. So if you're breaking the law anyway, I think there's a sense of like, why not do like go all the way? Because like everything is illegal, it seems at this point.
Melissa, I just want to ask you really how we got here, because I think many people felt that Myanmar had entered, in fact, a kind of more stable period of balance between, you know, the civilian government led by Aung San Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy, won a second landslide election victory in November, and the military, who still had a lot of reserve powers in this 2008 constitution that they'd spent many, many years writing, and things all fell apart 2 weeks ago, quite unexpectedly. And what's your sense now, we've had a little bit of time to consider things, of why this happened? Why did the military and Min Aung Hlaing feel they had to seize power as they did?
So the 2020 elections were a key part of the issues in dispute. So in November 2020, people in Myanmar went to the elections, and the National League for Democracy again won an overwhelming majority of seats. This basically meant there was no possibility that the commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, could be president. And many, you know, had speculated that perhaps he did have those ambitions. Since the election, the military has then raised numerous concerns and disputes with the Union Election Commission and publicly claiming and alleging that there is voter fraud, although there hasn't really been substantive evidence of this. Tensions escalated as a result of that between the military and the NLD. And in particular, this year was the deadline for Min Aung Hlaing in terms of having to step down from his position as commander-in-chief because he turns 65 around mid-year. If he had had to step down, that would have been the first time that a president who is a civilian, not from the military, would have had a role in potentially appointing the commander-in-chief. I think that's actually quite significant to keep in mind. And in addition to personal ambitions, perhaps of Min Aung Hlaing, would have broadly been a symbolic shift, perhaps away from the control of the military and towards a system where actually civilian authorities have more say over who is the commander-in-chief. So I think it's a combination of these things, but certainly in January, in the last few weeks of January, we were aware that tensions were growing. There were various statements made in the media by representatives from the military to the effect that they might even revoke the constitution. There was a lot of heated discussion and debate around that, and the military sort of quickly came back to reassure people that it would abide by the constitution. But what we're now seeing is that although this is clearly a coup, that the military is actually claiming sort of constitutional legitimacy for this and claiming that its actions are still legal.
I mean, given to everyone on the ground, to everyone outside, this is obviously a coup, although I know that the military have ordered the local media to stop saying that it is. Does it matter whether this was done constitutionally or not? Isn't this just an exercise in raw power? I mean, what's the relevance of the constitution here? And why is the military so keen to try and argue that it has, in fact, acted in accordance with this document?
Well, I certainly agree with Eamonn that the current situation raises a huge number of questions about what is law, does law still exist in Myanmar, and why should we even bother following it? But I think, one, the constitution still matters for a number of reasons. First of all, it does tell us something about how the military is acting or claiming to act, and perhaps the kinds of things that it might do next, or the ways in which it might try to claim legitimacy for its actions. And also, I think it is a way to remind the military again of how they are in many ways breaching their own rules that they created. So, for example, on the morning of the coup, it was the military who'd organized the arrest of the president. Now, there are a number of problems with that. One, it seems that actually the constitution doesn't allow a president simply to be arrested. There is an impeachment process if any sort of allegations are to be made against a sitting president. But also, once they then effectively took the president out of action, one of the vice presidents claimed to be acting in his place, even though the president clearly had not voluntarily given up his position. And none of the sort of reasons for giving up his position, such as incapacity or death, are clearly relevant here. So I guess that at that particular moment in time, it was fairly clear that the military jumped a step and kind of went ahead to some of the other parts of the constitution that allow the commander-in-chief to take control, but they never actually met the conditions and the process to get there in the first place.
If I could jump in on that a little bit too, I think it's also important to look at the language that the military is using in order to what is essentially gaslight the Myanmar public into accepting their claims of legitimacy, and sort of how that fits into the broader narrative of how the military presents itself both to the nation and the world, right? The Myanmar military really sees itself as a protector of the nation. A lot of sort of like their mission, the language around their mission is about protecting Myanmar unity, protecting it from sort of degeneration from either within or without. And so, by invoking the constitution, by invoking the language that they're using when they amend the laws about, waging war of like unscrupulous characters, these sorts of things, the military is reaffirming its role as protectors of the nation and framing everyone who isn't on their side as people who are trying to destroy the nation. And so, even if, we can all see that they are essentially just misusing law or, willfully misinterpreting things or misapplying things, it still matters, I think, that, this is the language through which they're justifying it.
And one of the great ironies, I guess, is that the military spent many years drawing up the 2008 constitution and this pathway to, I think, what they call discipline, flourishing, democracy. I mean, now they've seemingly torn up, their own constitution. How far do you think this sets back Myanmar? Is this just about sort of turning back to 2010 or 2008? Or is this something sort of much, much deeper? I mean, if they ignore their own constitution, does this set back democracy and progress in Myanmar much further than that?
So I think certainly on the first day of the coup, some of the immediate questions that people were asking is, well, if this is a coup, if this act was not constitutional, does that mean we can now, presume that the 2008 constitution doesn't apply? Does that now open up space for us to start something new, to do something different? And so I think there's a tension here between, on the one hand, I guess, wanting to hold the military to the rules it created because clearly it hasn't followed them, while at the same time recognizing that most people didn't like the rules in the first place. Most people didn't feel as though they'd had a say in the process, and the whole drafting of the constitution many years ago was done in a way that was undemocratic and completely under the control of the military. So I think there are those tensions at place, if you like, and really this does not help the military at all if it is actually intending to continue to rule the country through this constitution in the future. I think they have really abused people's trust in the sense that, even if you think of the NLD, they didn't enter the 2010 elections. They held out until 2012. But even once they entered parliament in 2012, initially they refused to take the oath, which was about basically sort of swearing a loyalty to this particular constitution. Now, they did in the end. And so in some sense, you know, there are a whole range of actors who agreed to sort of enter this system and work under its terms. And now people feel like that's been completely disregarded and, you know, that there's no reason anymore to be playing by the military's rules.
And A, you said that the military is trying to present itself as sort of the defender of the nation and the defender of unity. I mean, are there many people in Myanmar who buy that? Are there any people who are convinced by that kind of argument?
I mean, I think if we're going to talk about how persuasive the military's presentation of themselves is, we don't really need to look that much further than the way in which the broad Myanmar public, and obviously this isn't everyone, really began to support them during the Rohingya crisis, right? Like, there's this deep, pervasive strain of xenophobia in Myanmar. And, you know, we're in a moment where there's people with signs at the protest saying, like, do a drone strike. Like, we want the US and the UN to do a drone strike in Naypyidaw. But, you know, this is a polar opposite of the sort of rhetoric you were seeing just a few months ago. Well, maybe a year ago at this point, during the international court proceedings regarding Myanmar, where, and, you know, really starting from 2015-16 onwards, where people were saying the military are protectors from these outside invasions and, you know, using extremely racist rhetoric to talk about that. And even now, like, you see people, yesterday you saw a lot of people speculating that a number of the soldiers on the street were actually Chinese, and they were basing this on, you know, a lighter skin color and just sort of like racist stereotyping. So visual markers of race, despite all of the evidence, the literal decades of civil war that many people, or especially ethnic and religious minorities, have been suffering under in their relations to the military. You have people who still don't quite believe that, you know, a Buddhist Burma, like their Buddhist Burma military, is going to, you know, do this to them. And there's still lots of calls for people who are saying, you know, you need to go back to the barracks as opposed, and, you know, like reestablish our elected leaders as opposed to more radical things like abolish the 2008 constitution and radically change the way in which the military is governed in Myanmar.
We know that in previous occasions when military governments in Myanmar have faced kind of widespread or even quite limited protests, they've used extreme violence to bring an end to the protests. Now, what's your sense, A, this time? Is that something that people are afraid of? And do you think that the spread of smartphones, of social media, changes the balance of power here? Because obviously it gives people to some extent on the ground the ability to organize, but also to give, as long as there's internet access, you know, a window to the outside world into what's going on. Does that change the power dynamics on the ground? Or is there a fear that we're likely to see a similar violent sort of end game to these protests as we have in the past?
On the optimistic side of this balance sheet, I think, you know, what we are seeing is a much slower escalation of violence than we've seen in the past, where in the past it's been sort of, they might have let a few days of protests go on and then they just start killing people in the streets, whether that's through guns or just like in 2007, we saw people just being beaten to death. Whereas now, despite our concerns about how the law is being used, there's clearly escalations, right? Like there's clearly at least the attempt to appear to be adhering to legal processes, giving warnings, you know, escalating from giving verbal warnings to water cannons, to rubber bullets, to live bullets. But at the same time, they, you know, the live bullets have already been used. Soldiers are deployed in the streets. There are tanks in cities with millions of people. And so, you know, what does that mean other than a sign from the military that they are willing to use lethal and, you know, much more indiscriminate force against the public?
I mentioned the internet. The military initially seemed to try a complete shutdown. They're looking to bring in new legal measures that would sort of curb the ability of internet service providers to do certain things and force them to hand over data. But why haven't they just shut down the internet? What's stopping them?
I don't know. This would be pure speculation. But I mean, one definite reason that people, you know, at least part of the internet's being kept on. So, you know, when you look at what's being blocked in Myanmar, you can see that only 85% of the internet has been blocked. So there's still, you know, a decent proportion of the internet, or like there's still a decent level of connectivity in Myanmar. So one big reason for this is likely financial services require the internet. And, you know, the military wants very many things, but one thing they clearly want is to hoard wealth and capital. And without the internet, that would be quite difficult for them to do. You know, I'm sure on some level, they're also using the internet to communicate. But to sort of go back to your question earlier, I'm not sure how much the Myanmar military cares about international condemnation and these sorts of things. I think their concern when they're shutting down the internet is not communication out from Myanmar, but communication between people and people organizing. I don't necessarily know if they care if, you know, atrocities are being filmed. Although, like, you know, they clearly don't want people to do that. But I think their concern is not that there are witnesses, but that these would incite people and galvanize people.
And the military itself and the government uses Facebook to communicate, right? It's a standard method of communication with the public and even internally to some degree. So I guess it would have a direct impact on their own ability to operate.
Yeah, it's also a really great tool for the misinformation campaigns that's been going on. There's clearly been attempts by, you know, nefarious actors. We don't know exactly who have been trying to either incite panic or just confuse the public.
So Melissa, as A said there, you know, there's a sense that the military government, the military don't really care about the outside world, but we have obviously seen governments, including US and Australia and others, issue, I guess, the predictable condemnations, calls for the release of Aung San Suu Kyi and other effective political prisoners. We've seen the new Biden administration bring in some targeted sanctions as well. I mean, what do you think that the Western governments should be doing from this point? And do you think realistically it can make any difference?
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, I just want to note that obviously there have already been protests and demonstrations in support of the people of Myanmar at the embassy in Canberra, and as there has been in places around the world. So I think, you know, now there are a lot more Burmese diaspora around the world outside of Myanmar than there was in 1988, who are all, you know, looking at this in horror and trying to lobby their respective governments to do something about this. Obviously, there are particular difficulties now, I think, because of COVID. And I really think we can't afford to forget that we're still in a global pandemic, right? And that many governments have promised aid for health, vital health services that Myanmar, you know, does not have or can't adequately provide to its people. So there's a real dilemma here. And I think while the sanctions argument is perhaps a slightly easier one, even though that's never easy, in terms of there is more information now for governments to be able to make very targeted sanctions against particular military personnel and the companies that they connect to. That's pretty clear. And I think we'll see more governments make those targeted sanctions. We're also, of course, seeing some companies take their own initiatives. And I think the Japan Kirin Holdings Company, which had a joint venture with a military affiliate company in Myanmar, I mean, that was huge for them to say that they're going to pull out of that joint venture. So we're seeing it from the private sector as well. But in terms of governments, I mean, it's difficult. There are the obvious statements, as you say, and various levels of severity that these statements have issued condemnation, I guess, of what has happened, a call for the electoral results to be respected, and a call for the release of all those who've been arbitrarily detained. I think ultimately, though, a lot of what's going to happen next will depend on the people in Myanmar. One of the biggest perhaps sources of hope there, if you like, is the civil service sector and the ways that we're seeing people within the civil service refuse to go to work, you know, leave their work, whatever it might be, express their dissent in ways which is not usually common for the civil service and which would potentially significantly disrupt the military's ability to kind of run the country or any semblance of kind of running the administration. So I think that going forward is a real area to watch.
And A, what's your sense there? People who are protesting, risking a lot, I mean, what do they expect or what do they want to see from the outside world? What would actually be helpful, do you think?
I think that really goes back to the question of what the demands are from the CDM movement, the civil disobedience movement. And I think right now we haven't seen a consolidation around a set of key demands the way we saw in Hong Kong, for example. If you go out to the protests, even in Yangon, which is, you know, largely, I mean, Yangon's a quite a diverse city, but, you know, it's a very pro-NLD area. It's very Burma, it's very Buddhist. You're seeing a lot of very different signs, people calling for different things, you know. And if you go around the country, that's the demands are even more diverse. And in many ways, they are in opposition to each other. I've largely divided them into two contingencies or two groups, where one is the sort of return to status quo group, where they want the political prisoners released. And many of them don't even say that. They want Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint released. Right? They don't necessarily include everyone in that group, at least not on the signage. And they want the military to undo the coup, and they want the government to be formed as per the election results. And then you have another group of people who are demanding like land reform. They're demanding the federalism. They're demanding really of either, yeah, a complete abolishment and rethinking of the constitution. And so, you know, these groups have historically not gotten along, and they also seem to not be communicating very much either, even as the protests are wearing on. And so when it comes to calls for aid from the international community and what the international community can do, it really depends on which side, really, the international community wants to support, right? Like the sort of more radical change side will inherently have more ethnic and religious minorities, many of whom, you know, are either part of or in contact with ethnic arms group. And the international community has shown itself to be quite reluctant to be supportive of of protest movements that resort to violence. And it's much more likely that that group will do that. And so it also kind of depends on sort of the geopolitics of that. But I mean, I think, you know, sanctions are a good start. What New Zealand is doing in terms of refusing to recognize the new military regime is a good start. Pressuring organizations and companies not to either collaborate or assist the military regime is a good start. I mean, you know, I've worked in sort of digital security, digital literacy, that field in Myanmar, and the majority of government offices here use Gmail. They don't have proper servers and services that most world governments do have. Like, it wouldn't take that much to, at least temporarily, really damage the military's ability to communicate and to try to run civil service offices, even beyond sort of the general humans who are striking, by companies like Google simply saying, you know, your emails no longer work.
Yeah, we live in a world now where, you know, sanctions from Google or Facebook are arguably much more effective than those from even the government of the world's most powerful nation. It's interesting, A, as well, you mentioned Hong Kong. I mean, do you think protesters on the ground have been learning about tactics, how to protest, how to engage with each other in the outside world from other places? I mean, it's something we saw in Indonesia, in Thailand in the last year, people learning, you know, how to protect themselves from tear gas, how to get their messages out by, you know, sharing hashtags, even on apps they're not normally familiar with. Has that happened in Myanmar as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's been quite a few articles out now about Myanmar joining the Milk Tea Alliance. And I mean, clearly the three fingers up symbol is something that has been adopted through conversations with protesters in Thailand. The first few days of protests, especially when people were still very unclear about what was going to happen, and sort of the massive street protests hadn't become an everyday thing. People would not tell you, organizers would not tell you when and where you were protesting. They just simply told you to be ready in the morning. And, you know, within the hour of the protest, they would announce where to be. And so, you know, people are clearly learning from other countries. But you also see adaptation of strategies here. In Mandalay, there was a day where protesters decided instead of going up to police barricades, they would simply reroute. And so police ended up just guarding empty streets for hours, and people started putting up signs that said, enjoy the zoo, and things like that. And yeah, like you really see people adapting and learning both from international protests, but also very quickly on the ground through changing times.
Well, I think one thing's for sure, we've seen the protesters using a lot of creativity, and also the military government's going to be using a lot of legal creativity to plot its way forward. And I want to lastly, before we round up, turn to that question of where things go next. It's always, you know, very hard to predict social movements, especially the interplay between people on the streets, a military government with a history of violent repression. So rather than ask for a prediction, Melissa, I want to ask you, what are some of the pathways that Myanmar could take from here as we look out beyond, you know, the next few months?
Well, if we took the military at their word, although that's hard to do right at the moment, they're saying, you know, that the commander-in-chief will be in power for a year. And after that time, I think within a six-month period, they will actually hold another election to then form a government. Of course, they could potentially extend the state of emergency beyond 1 year. That's entirely possible. I think, you know, a worst-case scenario, if there was a sense of frustration from the military side, I mean, maybe that they would just revert to saying that they're ruling by martial law in terms of a post-1988 situation. So back then, you know, there was no constitution. The military just claimed to be ruling by martial law, which was kind of basically whatever it wanted to do. I don't think, you know, we're at that point, and I think the military is still really scrambling to try to justify itself to some extent, but I think it's really only focused on a local audience. I think what we hope is that there won't be an escalation of violence. We hope that there won't be mass arrests, although, of course, there has been some violence and quite a number of arrests already. And I do think, yeah, the hope also lies in this real creativity in protesters on the ground who are adapting daily, as has been said, and who are even doing things like, you know, the hacking of government websites, I have found quite encouraging. And so I think we'll continue to see surprises like that in coming days.
And A, what about from your perspective, what do you see as kind of the pathways forward? And I mean, how far ahead can people even think when you're in the thick of an uncertain situation like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think like one of the main obstacles the civil disobedience movement is going to face is long-term sustainability. I think especially with the younger generation, there is a very optimistic hope that, you know, these street protests, mass demonstrations, will be effective and quite quickly. But I think people need to be prepared for the possibility that this will drag on for at least a year until the supposed election that may or may not happen, but possibly longer. And, you know, to damage an institution that already holds a lot of wealth and can protect and exploit a lot of resources through guns can take a while. Yesterday, the military was reported to have taken quite a lot of money out of the Myanmar Economic Banks 1 and 2. And so I think longevity is going to be the main obstacle that people need to be thinking about. And I think that's sort of a unique blind spot of youth. And I'm including myself in that. But yeah, like civil servants, you know, most of them live in government housing. Where will they go? Are they all going to be fired? How will people feed themselves? There's nearly a million migrant workers who have come back because of COVID who may or may not be able to leave. There's just a lot of unemployed people. So, you know, how is the civil disobedience movement going to distribute resources in order to counteract whatever persuasive measures that the military government decides to take to try and break apart the movement? You know, can people unite in a way that is ethnically and religiously inclusive? I think there's a lot of underlying issues in Myanmar that this movement could potentially start to address. And if it doesn't, then there's quite a lot of issues that a powerful institution with lots of money can use to divide the public.
Well, on that note, thanks, A, and thanks, Melissa, for sharing your thoughts in these troubling times. Certainly more questions than answers raised from this conversation. But I think both your perspectives have really been invaluable in helping us try and get some sense of where things are and where they might go. So thanks again for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute, hosted by Institute experts with production assistance from Jennifer Reinhardt. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode.